Hold up. Before we get into this next episode, I want to tell you about our virtual conference that's coming up on February 15th and February 22nd. We did it two Thursdays in a row this year because we wanted to make sure that the maximum amount of people could come for each day, since the lineup is just looking absolutely incredible. As you know, we do. Let me name a few of the guests that we've got coming because it is worth talking about. We've got Jason Louis, we've got Shreya Shankar, we've got Dhruv, who is product applied AI at Uber. We've got Cameron Wolf, who's got an incredible podcast and he's director of AI at Rebuy Engine. We've got Lauren Lockridge, who is working at Google, also doing some product stuff. Oh, why is there so many product people here? Funny you should ask that, because we've got a whole AI product owners track along with an engineering track. And then, as we like to, we've got some hands-on workshops too. Let me just tell you some of these other names just for a moment, you know, because we've got them coming and it is really cool. I haven't named any of the keynotes yet either, by the way. Go and check them out on your own. If you want, just go to home.mlops.community and you'll see. But we've got Tunji, who's the lead researcher on the DeepSpeed project at Microsoft. We've got Holden, who is the open source engineer at Netflix. We've got Kai, who's leading the AI platform at Uber. You may have heard of it. It's called Michelangelo. Oh my gosh. We've got Fazan, who's product manager at LinkedIn. Jerry Louis, who created good old Llama Index. Oh, he's coming. We've got Matt Sharp, friend of the pod. Shreya Rajpal, the creator and CEO of Guardrails. Oh my gosh, the list goes on. There's 70 plus people that will be with us at this conference. So I hope to see you there. And now let's get into this podcast.
Hi, my name is Alexandra Dean. I am the head of cloud analytics and machine learning operations at Gjensidige, an insurance company in Norway. And I like to drink my coffee black.
What's happening, gang? Welcome back to another MLOps Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitri Ose, and I just got off this call with Alexandra, and what a call it was. She is doing some really fascinating stuff when it comes to enabling the teams at her company. Her team basically just is like the SWAT team for every other data team at the company. They go in there, and as she put it, they are trying to make themselves redundant. So their whole idea is, how fast can we get in and get out? It's like the extraction team almost. I don't know if SWAT team is the best metaphor, but when you listen to it, you'll know what I'm talking about. So they go in, they figure out the MVP, whatever that needs to get done to make sure that happens and the data product gets shipped, they do it. And then they get out. They leave it in the hands of the team that asked for whatever it was to get built. And they also are making sure that all of these different teams understand cross-functionally what other teams are doing. So, oh, we saw that the accounting team needs something like this, and it just so happens that our sales development team did something along these lines. We could probably generalize what the learnings are and the problem is here in order to say that we can solve this problem the same way. So if that doesn't catch your attention, the other piece that I think might be of interest to you is how she talked about bringing software engineering best practices to the data teams and the data science teams. That is something that we talk about a lot. You've probably heard it being said on LinkedIn or in the MLOps community and how useful it is. She mentions this. She talks about how much her game was up-leveled because of learning the software engineering best practices of clean code and just getting ready for production, and how she makes sure that the teams that she works with, when they go in there as that SWAT team, if we're going to stay with that metaphor, they're able to have code that's ready for production, and they're able to not get stuck in that exploratory data loop that some of us are familiar with. So hope you enjoy this episode of the MLOps Community Podcast. And right now I've got a new little segment for us, which I like to call, let's read what some of our users think about the MLOps community. This is a segment that I am going to read off some of the comments that you all leave in the MLOps community, YouTube or Spotify or all that. The only catch is some of this shit is not nice. So let's go through it. It's almost like reading mean tweets. Here we go. So we've got Dev Yuns commented, "What a waste of time. Please get more qualified interviewers and interviewees." Thank you, Deb Yuns. Good thing I go to therapy, and that stuff does not hurt me anymore. Next up, Johnny Ronnie commented, "You are a hack. Learn how to play the guitar. I can't believe that I spent time watching this." Noted. Last but not least, we've got Mr. Shooby Dooby saying, "This was an utter quagmire of a talk." Two thumbs up to that. So if you all are interested in letting me know what you think of these talks and podcasts, you know where to find me. Leave a review. I will make sure to read it off in the next episode. We'll see you on the other side. Where to start? Where are you in the world, by the way?
I'm in Oslo, in Norway.
Okay, cool. Are you originally from there?
No, I'm German, and I've lived a little bit around the world, and have now settled for Norway. So I've been here for 6 years now.
Yeah, I've heard beautiful things about the fjords. Is that how they're pronounced?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, they're super nice. We don't have those kind of views in Oslo. We have to travel a bit to get those, but it's always worth. But yeah, I've kind of, since I moved here, I kind of lost interest in traveling abroad that much.
Yeah, so I'm actually in Germany right now. Funny enough, I am where you hail from, and I'm right outside of Frankfurt.
Okay. Cool.
Are you from this region? Where are you from in Germany?
Not quite. I'm from Nuremberg.
Okay. Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So not too south. Yeah, southeast.
Yeah, totally. Very cool. So I'm in the middle of the countryside.
And yeah.
I like to make jokes at the Germans' expense because my neighbor, I wave at them every single day, and I am hoping, like, I'm hanging on. I've been here for 4 years. I'm hanging on to this little sliver of hope that one day they will wave back to me.
Oh, I hope that happens.
I've got some people, I should say, that they noticed me right when I moved into the town. I'm in a town of like 100 people, right? And so there are some neighbors that are full on, like, they wave to me now first and they're on board. And then others, they're holding out and they do not wave at all. They just stare at me, they bug me. And it's like, why is this guy waving at me?
I think the best way to engage with Germans who you don't know from before is by finding something to mutually complain about together.
Yeah. That's it. I got to figure out what we can complain about, and then I'll be on their level, and they'll take me in and invite me over to dinner.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Oh, man. That's great. Excellent. Well, I think we should probably start with a bit about your background. I know you have a lot of experience in applied mathematics and statistics, but I want to hear from you, like, what's your story? How did you get into tech?
So as you said, I started out with applied mathematics. So actually I started out with bioinformatics, which basically is statistics for medicine. And then I started, I decided to do a PhD in applied math, also applied to medicine. In Southampton, in England, because I was convinced that I was going to be an academic. I was going to be a professor. And so I did the whole...
What? How did that dream go away?
It's It went away because of the temporary nature of postdoc positions. So I had one postdoc position right after my PhD in England, and then I Brexited because I didn't really feel that the political situation was moving in a direction that I thought was so productive.
Wait, so you left Britain and you Brexited?
Yeah, I did. I did leave because of Brexit, yeah. And then I moved to Norway and took a postdoc here that I was lucky enough to get because of the network that I had with other researchers. And then that was a temporary position for 2 years. And then at the end of that position, it took a long time for them to tell me whether I get another 2 years or not. And it just never, even though I got another position, it never stopped feeling like there was a sword dangling over my head about the temporary nature of the position. And I knew that if I wanted to be a professor, I would have to move country at least once more. But I really started liking Norway. So then I became a consultant. And that was basically my entrance into tech. And because I was the first data scientist at that consultancy that they employed, I had to work on software development projects first to be profitable. And then I realized, there's a lot of methods in software development actually that we should apply in data science. And I started doing that with my then data science clients. Uh-huh. And then there was this position at ENCD, at the insurance company that I'm at now, before head of cloud analytics and MLOps. So leading a team that would precisely do that. So applying software development methods into the data space and leading that change within data.
So presumably this first consultancy job that you got, they really needed a data engineer or a software engineer, and they hired a data scientist, and then they threw all of this software engineering at you, and you were like, well, I guess I could do this too.
Yeah, I gotta give them a little bit more credit. So they were really working on getting proper data science contracts with me, but just because they didn't have any experience in that yet, it took a little while. And so they asked me if I could work on software development in the meantime, with the promise that they would still actively sell me to data science projects and be able to pull me from software engineering whenever we got a project.
And then that skill set in turn made you stronger as a data scientist.
Exactly, because at the beginning I was thinking, oh, okay, I guess I'll do that because then at least I have something meaningful to do. But then it turned out to be a great asset.
Yeah, boon. And what made you like Norway so much? That's just me, who's never been to Norway. I've just seen it on videos and seen all the incredible nature that they have. Is that what it was or what?
Yeah, that was a big, big factor. So I really needed to have proper snow back in my life. So I've been downhill skiing since I was 4 years old. So my parents would always take us to the Alps once a year as kids. And while I was living in England and also the other countries, there was no one basically that I could go skiing with. And it would have been a very complicated trip to do so. And so then there was a decision between basically Switzerland and Norway.
Yeah, Switzerland isn't bad too. Those are two nice choices. I understand. Great problems to be having where you want to spend
exactly.
Your time to improve. That's very cool. So there is something else before we move on that I wanted to touch on, and it's your contributions to Alzheimer's and debunking a few of the common approaches. Can you break that down before we get into all this consulting and MLOps and the software engineering and data and all that? But I just want to know about Alzheimer's. It's something near and dear to my heart because my grandma actually passed from Alzheimer's, and I think a lot of people probably know somebody that has Alzheimer's or has gone through that. What'd you do and what'd you contribute?
Yeah, so there was one theory that I debunked, But yeah, so basically, Alzheimer's is a very unnatural process of aging. And it's the result of a failure to clear waste products from your brain. So there's this particular protein called amyloid beta, which each of us produce all the time. You produce it right now, I produce it right now. But because our waste clearance mechanism work, we're fine. And once those, if those mechanisms start failing, then that's when that protein starts accumulating. And when that protein starts accumulating into larger chunks, then it starts degrading both your neurons and your synapses, which is what then eventually causes this cognitive decline that we see in patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what I was trying to work on was a theory of how this protein is normally cleared from the brain. Because the problem is once you see symptoms, it's most likely way beyond the point where you could do anything about it. So really prevention is what in my group we were aiming for. And so there was this theory that said that the way arteries pulsate in the brain would be driving this clearance mechanism. And so a lot of energy and also mice was spent on trying to show how this mechanism would work. But then I used equations and computer simulations to show that basically this theory doesn't hold, that just the pulsations themselves, they are not strong enough to drive this mechanism, and that there is a most likely another contributing factor from tiny muscle cells within the artery walls that have to, whose frequency of contraction instead could be the driving factor. But the biggest, because the problem in science always is, or mostly is, that we can't really prove things a lot of the time, but you can disprove things by basically just showing a counterexample. And so then that means you basically try to always, you come up with a theory and then you try to destroy it, you try to disprove it. And for as long as you can't disprove it, you can kind of assume, okay, maybe it's true. But then once you have been able to disprove it, then you can adjust your theory and work towards something that might be closer to the truth.
So you did all that and they still wouldn't give you a job as a professor.
Yeah, it takes a bit more research, contributions than that to become a professor. So then after Alzheimer's, I basically moved to studying the heart with the same methods.
Oh, wow.
And trying to figure out how perfusion, so the blood supply to the heart, is negatively affected by heart attacks, and then later on heart failure as a long-term consequence of heart attacks.
And you were using machine learning in these different research examples?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, there's one of the biggest problems with these models is that you have a lot of parameters in these models for which you basically can't take any measurements directly. And so what you would do is large parameter sweeps using a supercomputer, and then you use Bayesian methods for uncertainty quantification to try and convince doctors and other collaborators that what your models are predicting or what you're saying is actually useful.
This is neat stuff. So that was the almost like the before, and that's what you brought into the consulting game. And then you realized, well, now I need to start doing more software stuff. What are some things that you now recognize when it comes to software engineering that are gigantic level ups for you? And if you do not know them as a data scientist, you're basically digging your own grave. And maybe I'll start. If you don't know Git, then what are you doing? Other stuff, though, that you feel like you've learned. I know there are some quite vocal people in the MLOps community Slack about, like, you need to think about clean code, you need to think about production code, you can't be just going and exploring Jupyter Notebooks. Granted, this a lot of this has changed since the advent of LLMs, but I would love to hear like how you think about it right now and what things you're teaching the rest of your team, because I know that is you're advocating for, you're helping others understand the value of these software engineering practices.
Yeah, exactly. So there's two that you just mentioned, clean code, and then also, what was the second one now?
Yeah, I forgot. Code.
Yeah, production. Yeah, bringing code into production. Those hit the nail quite well on the head. So basically what we often see with data scientists is that they're really, really good at writing Python scripts, but they're not good and they've never been taught usually how to collaborate with code. So what often happens, and also, but also how to basically write code so that they can collaborate with themselves in a way later on. So when they when they're supposed to look at something that they've written 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And so these are the things that no one has taught them, but that I find really valuable to teach them, because that means that now once a person goes on holiday or is leaving a company, then you don't have this catastrophic effect of a model not being maintainable anymore. And actually, yeah, what's been a real, real asset from my time as a researcher into this, into also teaching and getting production, getting code into production, is this emphasis on hypothesis testing. So you basically come up with a hypothesis, and then you do, you write some code, and you write the minimum amount of code to basically test your hypothesis and your assumption. You put it into production, you test it, and then you iterate over that.
Mm. So funny that you mentioned that, because I literally last week was talking to somebody about this, Aparna, and I was mentioning how another person in the community very much was an advocate for that. And it's been something that has been floating around off and on in the community for, I think, like a year, year and a half, 2 years maybe by now, which is exactly that, like get something to production as fast as possible so you can know where the bottlenecks are, you can know where things are breaking down, you can know which data streams aren't actually working or which data is bad quality, all of that. You're not going to have an easy time figuring that out until you get to production. Not that it's easy when it gets to production, but at least you will have a better idea of what is working and what isn't.
Exactly. And then also you'll be able to figure out whether you're actually building the right thing. There's a difference between building the thing right and building the right thing. And I think we are often focusing too much on building the thing right and too little on building the right thing.
Yeah, that goes back to one of the first meetups we ever had in 2020, where I remember we talked to Dan Sullivan, and this quote stayed with me for all these years. So whatever, 4 years now, he mentioned how nobody on the business side cares about your F1 score. Nobody cares if your accuracy is 98% versus 97% if it totally misses the mark.
Exactly.
Because you, and that it is exactly what you're saying. It's like you have to build the right thing, not build the thing right. It's good to do both, ideally, but we need to really focus on building the right thing. And so what are some ways that you recognize if you're building the right thing as opposed to the thing right?
Yeah, so that's the biggest one is basically this hypothesis testing approach. I also actually fell into this pitfall when I had my first data science project as a consultant. And then basically the problem was that there wasn't the, my company basically gave it away for free as a test. To a client that we have a lot of, that we had a lot of other projects with. And so then a group that didn't know what they wanted a data scientist for was basically thrown at my feet. And I was supposed to try and figure out what we can use and what we can do for them. And so in the beginning, it's very easy then to basically get stuck into data exploration forever. And you could do data exploration for a long, long time. But once we started switching over to hypothesis-based testing and just talking to the customer more and involving them very closely, then we actually started being able to generate some value for them. So the long story short basically is that we always involve our stakeholders from the very beginning. And we spend a lot. We spend a lot of time at the beginning, also trying to come up with hypotheses, with several hypotheses that we can test, that the owner for the model, also the business value, would think, would see as valuable.
Yeah, and that was my question: is the customer? You say the customer, is it just another person in the business, or is it an end user from the product itself?
Yeah, so for us, it's often the owner of a let's say for example an end solution within our company. So we have if I use as an example a model factory for generating sales leads for our customer service advisors, then the owner of that would be the sales centers, or those people managing the sales centers, because they are the ones that rely on these leads that the models generate. It's also a little bit more complicated with us because my team, for example, doesn't own any of the models or any of the solutions that we help develop. We're basically a pure enabling team. So all of our models are earned by analytics teams that sit in the business units. So for example, either in private insurance or in commercial insurance. So they would earn the models, and we basically enter temporary collaborations with these teams. So usually two of my team will work together with two of the analytics team, and then together they will work on usually a minimum viable product first of a solution together, and then depending on how much time there's left, they will improve on it.
That's it.
And then we... During this collaboration, my guys will teach the analytics team how to write clean code, how to collaborate with code, and so on and so forth, so that then the analytics team is able to own and maintain their own solutions. And so we then basically pull out and work with the next team.
So the value add there is you making sure that there's some tangible deliverable that gets done.
Exactly.
You're the team that goes in and says, like, there's no messing around here. We got to get something out the door so that it's working, it's shipped, and then we're iterating on it as fast as possible.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So we basically, our biggest goal is to make ourselves redundant every single time we work with an analyst team.
And do you feel like the last couple of years have made your job significantly easier because of the tools that have come onto the market? Or is it a little bit like you don't pay attention to all that noise and you know what you're doing, you know you've got a great workflow that hits the mark, and so let's just go with that?
And so that's it's difficult to exactly answer the question for me, because I've only been in exactly that job for a year. And before that, I was a consultant. But it's for sure the tools that we have available in the cloud nowadays make this process a lot easier. So, for example, we've built a cloud data platform based on Databricks, and so that means we can in one platform we can our analysts can basically do everything from exploration and experiments to production-ready machine learning operations, and also orchestrating other code and what they might need, and then also the visualization reports and whatever else they might need.
Yeah, I think about that quite a bit when it comes to the tooling that's come out on the market, because of speaking to a few people at these bigger companies that we all think, oh, wow, they've got the most advanced ML and AI on the market. And you realize that because they've been doing ML since 2014 or 2016, they're actually a little bit legacy unless they're investing a lot of time and energy to continue and stay up with the greatest and latest trends and tools that are coming out that make your life a lot easier, because there has been a lot of learnings since 2016 on how things can be way easier. You can just think about Spark and how many different competitors there are to Spark and how difficult Spark is to learn. And there's a lot of people that are trying to streamline that and get you 80% of what you need from Spark for those use cases that don't need all these bells and whistles that Spark can give you. And it's 10 times easier, right? And
yeah, so exactly.
In that case, it's almost like I think a lot about that today, how much different it is if you are starting today versus starting in 2016, and how if you're one of these gigantic, fancy, big name tech startups that we've all heard of in Silicon Valley, we think that, wow, they're so amazing, but really they're probably sitting there and they're like, ooh, we might be hanging on by a shoestring, you know, unless you're adding a whole lot of resources, which, let's be fair, like a lot of them are, because they see the business value in it. They've seen the business value in it since 2016. So they recognize that they should be putting a lot of time and energy and resources in it. But that's something that for me, you know, I remember in 2019 when I was going around and going to conferences and trying to talk to people, and they would tell me how they were doing experiment tracking with Excel sheets.
Shit.
And that was how they would track their experiments. And it's like, wow, now there's a million tools out there that you can track your experiments with, right? And even in 2019, there was MLflow and weights and biases in that, but it wasn't a standard practice. And so kind of where I'm bringing it back around to what you're doing in teaching these analysts on the different benefits of having clean code and production ready, and then being able to bring that to production as quick as possible, it does seem like there are tools out there that can greatly benefit and streamline that process.
Exactly. And actually, you're also touching on another aspect that my team is responsible for, which is basically finding out in all of these tools that there are, finding out which one should we use. Because that's the other challenge, right? When there's so many tools to choose from, then I think that compels people paradoxically even more so to fall back onto something that feels very familiar, like Excel. And so that's where I think you also need basically this role of an enabling team that looks at the available tech stack and then comes up with a recommended one.
All right, real quick, some words from our sponsor, Zaliz, and then we'll be right back into the program. Are you struggling with building your retrieval augmented generation, aka RAG applications? You are not alone. We all know tracking unstructured data, conversion, and retrieval is no small feat. But there's a solution available now. Introducing Zaliz Cloud Pipelines from the team behind the open source vector database, Milvus. This robust tool transforms unstructured data into searchable vectors in an easy manner. It's designed for performance. Zaliz Cloud Platforms Pipelines. Zaliz Cloud Pipelines also offer scalability and reliability. They simplify your workflow, eliminating the need for complex customizations or infrastructure changes. Elevate your RAG with high-quality vector pipelines. Try Zaliz Cloud Pipelines for free at zaliz.com. You can find the link in the description. Let's get back into this podcast.
For your company, so that basically you can then build also a network of super users who will be able to help their peers. So you can also scale the approach. It doesn't mean that everyone has to use the same tools, but at least there's a recommended set of tools if you don't know where to start, if you're not sure what to do, or if you don't care what you use, then you know at least there is a resource available for you to help you get started, and also probably many examples of things that other people have done in your company that are similar to your problems, which is another thing that we work with.
To make sure to get that out in the open, and as opposed to keeping it in a silo?
Yeah, so basically it's making sure that we don't invent the wheel anew every single time. Because so what I think my company is doing quite really right is to own the data and the analytics models in the domain, in the business domains. And so that means we have about 20 different analyst teams in the different business divisions. And so because the day is only so and so long, right, they don't necessarily know what, so people who work in pricing don't necessarily know what people in developing the private insurance products work on, and vice versa. But because we go and work with the different analyst teams and then go to the next one and to the next one, we can see where there's synergies between different problems that teams are facing, and then we can tell them, oh, but this other team in commercial, they've actually had this exact same problem, and together with them we solved it in this way, so we believe that that would also be a suitable solution for you guys.
And how have you seen the analysts take to becoming basically data scientists / machine learning engineers types in a way?
So the ones that we've worked with so far, and we're lucky enough still that we can pick and choose to work with the ones who are really keen. Yeah. So they really enjoyed it. And they actually, we had an internal conference in September, and I sent basically one of the teams that implemented a model factory for these sales leads that I was talking about earlier. And they basically opened their presentation by saying, yeah, we feel like we're more software engineers now than we actually are data scientists. But they seem to enjoy that that new kind of role quite a lot. So they're doing great. And then there's other analyst teams that we've actually worked on pure basically software kind of solutions with. So so it doesn't necessarily have to be machine learning when machine learning is overkill. Who also seem to enjoy being able to build more automated software based on the data, so that then they actually have more spare time to start thinking about smarter things that they could do with the data instead of basically debugging and maintaining all the time.
Yeah, you're freeing up their time. That makes a lot of sense. And it's funny that the analysts are now considering themselves software engineers. I know that for me, the first time I submitted a PR, changed all of my profile photos to be like, I am now Hackerman. Don't call me Demetrius. You better watch your data. You better watch your systems, because I am Hackerman. I know what I'm doing now. I can use Git. I am ready to take on the internet. So I feel where they're coming from in that regard. And so it feels to me like you've got this enabling function, but you also have a bit of an R&D function of going out there, figuring out, A, who's doing what and how can we enable them and make sure that they have exposure to what the other team is doing, so that if there is overlap, we can get them talking and get them using the same tools or trying to solve it in the same way, and reduce that time to production and reduce that time in exploratory mode. But then the other thing is, you're going out there and you're saying, look, there's a million tools on the market. There's a million ways that we can solve that. And that's not even, we didn't talk at all about AI and LLMs yet, but I imagine that totally threw a little bit of a wrench in all the stuff you've been doing and what people are asking for. So you have to go out there and you have to say, here's some tools that we would recommend. This gets our stamp of approval. We're already paying for them with this team over here. You can just join and we'll buy another seat. I imagine that's kind of how the conversation goes. And so you're the one that's constantly tasked with exploring the newest, greatest, latest things on the market, and then making the business case for bringing them on and actually either supporting them if they're open source or paying for them if they're managed?
Yeah, so there's a funny you mentioned also, so that's pretty much right. And funny you mentioned LLMs also. I think it's only a matter of time before my title will be renamed to Head of AI and MLOps.
That's a big title right there. Let's just better come with a salary bump. That's all I'm saying.
But it's also fun that people like to basically feel enthusiastic about these new technologies and new ways of using machine learning. So we've implemented two reference cases now that are basically in one of them is in production in a way that we tested with a specific pool of test users. And the other one is still in development, but will be close to testing probably within the next sprint.
Because I imagine there is a pull towards some self-serve motions. So instead of you going in there and you doing things homegrown, it's like there's this SaaS product that will get us, again, maybe 90% of the way there, or it's specifically built for analysts and we can use that. Have you tried to look at that or those types of tools as options? Do you feel like siloed, or is that something that you're currently using?
Yeah, so that's also one of the projects we're currently running, again with the same analysts or data scientists who have developed the model factory for sales leads, because originally that was written in code, and we together with them or mostly them wrote it all themselves. But now they and we were expecting maybe that they would have a sort of ownership to that code that would prevent them from wanting to try out ready-made solutions. Because that's also something that we often see with analysts, that they have a little bit more ownership to their code than is healthy, I would say. But in this case, it was them who said, oh no, we've seen that basically feature store in Databricks would give us the opportunity to probably get rid of 90% of the code that our model factory is made of. Can you guys help us do that? And so now two of my guys are working on that. And
yeah.
So when it works, we hopefully have gotten rid of about 90% of the code that doesn't need to be maintained anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can ideally generalize that to other parts of the business that could find use from that.
Exactly. But this is a group that we're quite lucky with, that they are so enthusiastic about this about this way of using tools. I know there are also other teams who have spent a significant amount of time, many years, and built tools for doing their pricing or whatever it may be.
Sure.
And so those will be a bit more of a challenge to convince to try the other approach. But I think this kind of change management is also a very fun challenge.
Yeah, because it's funny because it's very much on the human level. Then you're not really able to make logical arguments. It's more like they have their nostalgia for the way that things are done. It's comfortable, and that is the way that we do it. Why would we want to reorganize our processes? It's going to take us a long time. We're going to have to, it's going to be painful. Then we may not do things right. There's so many reasons why you don't want to change. But if you're stagnant, then that's you're worse off, in my opinion.
Exactly. But we shouldn't also forget that to basically acknowledge the amount of effort that teams have put into building their solutions. And that, of course, is if then suddenly someone comes along and tells you we don't need 90% of your code anymore because we have this product that does it all for you. That's not easy to handle.
What's that? There's a term for that where you've like spent so much money on something that you got to see it through. It's
what is it?
It's something like
sunk cost fallacy.
That's it. The sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah.
So it's almost like that with the code. Like, we've already put so much effort into building this. We're not going to just give it to some verticalized. And I mean, one thing, the other part that I was thinking about is, yeah, feature store still to me feels like it's not quite a fully verticalized SaaS type thing, where I was thinking, since LLMs have taken the scene and every SaaS tool now has AI capabilities, you have your HR department, or you have your legal department, or you have your sales department now that says, you know what, we don't need to create our own, let's take a chatbot for lack of creativity on my side, and let's say we don't need to create our own chatbot with all the data and train our model and get something out real quick, because we just can buy this off the shelf solution and it'll get us 90% of the way there. Have you seen people starting to demand that? Or have you seen the other thing? The other piece of it is, you've got someone that says, oh, you know what would be really nice, if we had some API calls out to OpenAI and it went to GPT and it made our lives easier in these like five different workflow steps. And they're now including AI into their business, but it's not necessarily like what you're used to doing, where it's a full overhaul. You're going in there, you're saying, hey, if we're going to do this, we got to get something out. We want to be from soup to nuts. We want to be in control of it. It's more like, I don't want to say half-assed. It's just like when you talk MVP, it's the ultimate MVP version.
Yeah, so we're a little bit both sides and in the middle of it, because so the our biggest problem currently with the with the generative AI solutions within other products is that they are usually the distributors are usually quite thin on data governance, and so it's difficult. Basically, these are difficult for us to purchase at the moment, because we have very sensitive data about the entire Norwegian population, and even more so on the part of the population that are our customers, that we can actually not just go and buy these solutions before they have put more meat on the table in terms of data governance, what they do with our data then, and where it gets sent to. We were out pretty early with requesting access to the GPT models locked within Asia, because that's our chosen cloud service provider anyway. And so we are basically, the solutions that we work on at the moment are actually very specialized chatbots for very specific tasks that can make a lot of our internal processes more effective. So, for example, the one that we've just, finished enough to basically test it with test users is a chatbot that business developers who don't know how to write SQL can use to then basically query our databases with natural language. And so they can then get information about aggregated information about our customers back to make decisions instead of having to wait for an analyst to answer them. And the other one is a kind of RAG application, so retrieval augmented generation, where we try and improve the search for our customer advisors, so that when they talk with people on the phone, they can search in our internal documents live. But they are actually... Azure also has out of the box AI search solutions that we're basically comparing to our self-implemented RAG version. So there's a lot of learning also to be gained from basically implementing these solutions at least once yourself. But we always try and advocate to use these cloud native solutions for the actual production case.
Yeah, there is a lot of question marks when it comes to those verticalized SaaS solutions that you were talking about, because of the big unknowns when it comes to, so where's my data going and what is it doing? And are you training your model with it, or are you just sending it to OpenAI? How does that look? And we were talking about this last week in our build versus buy roundtable, and the folks from Quantum Black were saying how you can get different, you can be on a spectrum almost of, I don't care about my data and where it goes and who touches it, versus like next step might be, I use like an OpenAI, but I make sure that, or a third party API service provider, but I make sure that they're not training any models with that data that's coming through. It's my data, it stays with me, supposedly. Like, you got to kind of take it at face value that they're going to be actually doing that, because who knows what they're doing behind the scenes, but that's what they say, right? And you would hope that they follow the law or follow their own word. And then you say like, no, I need 100% control. So I'm going to do everything in-house and I'm going to do it with my own models. And I do like this use case though that you're talking about, which is keeping the AI stuff happening internally so that it's almost like the stakes are a little bit lower. Like this person, the business development person who's doing text to SQL, if everything goes haywire and the model totally hallucinates, it's not like it's going to ruin a customer relationship and potentially put you out millions of dollars.
Exactly. Or,
yeah, like the hallucination is okay there. You're not going to blow anything up, any relationships, any brand. You're not going to have really bad repercussions.
Exactly. And we have a lot of processes that we can make a lot more efficient with using generative AI before we even begin to directly let them talk to our customers. We have this principle at my company, which basically says that everything that we do needs to be able to tolerate the front pages of the yellow press. So it was following that principle, it was very clear for us from the beginning that we would want to focus on internal processes first. But also, of course, that means that basically then we can use our best customer service operators to basically work on those cases with those people that really need them. So we will be able to deliver basically more personal customer service by just making everything else internally as efficient as possible and then automating whatever can be automated.
Yeah. So how do you prioritize what use cases you're going after? It feels like you've got a whole spectrum of things that you can tackle, whether it's enabling other teams, it's optimizing current things that are there. And you mentioned how you're trying to just make yourself redundant. But then you've also got this other piece, which is, we could do a lot with AI, in quotation marks, and do that for the internal team and optimizing the way that the internal processes happen. Do you have a rubric on how you go about things?
Luckily, I haven't needed one that much yet. It's for lack of a better word, so I have to use a buzzword and say I do it in an agile way. But basically, it just so far, fingers crossed, it stays that way. But so far, it just worked out so that basically teams were ready to be able to work with us when we could start working with them. Other teams might have had to wait a little bit, but then we give them an approximate sort of start time. But one important principle is also to never basically promise how long a project is going to take, because you never know. And then it's also just, but I also use basically what my guys want to work on as a guidance. So I like to keep a happy team that works on interesting projects. But then in between two interesting projects, then I feel like it's nice to squeeze in a project that's maybe slightly less interesting from the technical perspective, but a huge gain in terms of business value. So like a minimum effort, kind of maximum result kind of project. That feels a little bit more like a chore, maybe, but it would be really important to do. So it's like, it's about balancing basically who works on what. And then I also try to always rotate out who in my team works together so that we can spread all the skills that we have amongst everyone.
So I hate to break it to you, but I think if you're going for that head of AI title on LinkedIn, you got to have some kind of rubric. You got to be coding how this is how we do AI at my company. Here's the formula for it and maybe some acronym. We got to find an acronym that you can say team, make sure the team is happy. So I just noticed that, like, that change management, kind of like what some people may consider a little bit more fluffy, that kind of stuff. And whenever you see someone talking about AI, I imagine you've seen the meme where it's like, if it is written in Python, it's machine learning. If it's written in PowerPoint, it's AI. If it's like, we'll figure out some kind of a rubric or some acronym that would be flashy. And then you can change your title. You can have it all, the head of AI, change management, all that fun stuff. But the other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about this, to come back to the point after that little sidebar, was around how you scope these different projects. Because as you were saying, like, oh, well, there might be a relatively low effort thing that can cause huge value for the business, or there might be something that is very valuable and it's probably going to be a little bit more involved. I know that from years of talking to data scientists and machine learning engineers, scoping out data projects is not quite as easy. I mean, scoping out software projects is not easy in general, but like when you add data to the mix, it just adds that extra layer of complexity. Have you figured out ways to at least contain scope creep and then the amount of time it takes to do things?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question as well. Actually, so with the last couple of projects, it so happened that we were able to deliver the solution quite significantly under time, because it turned out that the tools we were using, made some of the jobs so much easier than the original solution that we were trying to modernize had. So that was quite fun. But that makes my job usually, funnily enough, that makes my job harder, because it means I need to find new projects faster. So to actually answer your question, we focus a lot on the minimum viable product to production approach. So for example, we just started a project with a team that works on the profitability prognosis for all our insurance products. And so in the way they usually would have tackled a project, they would have basically done all the data transformations for each product first, and then all the modeling for each product next, and so on and so forth, and then the visualization for each product last. Whereas we are saying we're taking one product and then we're taking it from end to end, so that basically in the shortest amount of time, you learn how to do the entire solution end to end. Then we will take the next product, and probably we will try and pick the product that is going to be the trickiest.
Good.
And then we will work on that end to end. So if we then are out of time in terms of what we've allocated as time from the beginning, no worries, because then you know everything that you need to do to finish this. You don't need us anymore. Or we can, if we have, we can try and allocate more time. But ideally, they won't need us anymore and they will be able to finish the rest. But it's always this approach, this focus on end-to-end solutions from the start, from day one, that helps us.
It's almost like you're tasked with going from like one town to the next, and the way is not clear. You may have to go through the jungle, you may have to go over mountains, you may have to go through some pretty gnarly terrain, and you're going to figure out what is the way that we go, so you can map out that way. And then once you have the way mapped out, you've cut through the jungle, then you're like, okay, now let's bring all the supplies, let's make it a little bit more difficult so that we can really start to maximize the, maybe you even build a highway. Shoot, if we're thinking big, you say, no, we don't even want a trail anymore. We're going to set up a super highway and we're going to make sure that all of these supplies get from town A to town B in a fast fashion.
Yeah, but the point then is that we basically only build the highway if we actually end up needing the highway. So it could, if we're only shipping a very small number of products, we don't need more than a trail, maybe. So the way I usually try and visualize it is basically when your customer wants a car, or they think they want a car, then you're not gonna give them a wheel first or a set of two wheels. What you're gonna give them first is a skateboard, because you can get from A to B with a skateboard. It's gonna be slow, it's gonna be painful, but you're gonna get there. And then in the next step, you're getting them a bicycle. And then in the next step, you're getting them a motorbike. And maybe by the time you've given them a motorbike, they've actually already figured out we don't need the car. Instead of basically having first delivered a set of four wheels and then having delivered a chassis. And so you're actually able to deliver the entire business value from the actual minimum viable product, so the skateboard, in a way that's still painful, but it works. And then you take it from there.
Okay, that is a much better metaphor than I was putting together there. And it makes complete sense on how you are helping people understand that you've got this tool that is going to be useful and it's going to get you what you need. And then if you encounter that it is not living up to the standards or your needs and your requisites, then you can upgrade, because we got this fancy e-bike over here that will get you there a little bit faster. We can make sure that that's all you need. And then if you say, you know what, that's still not what you want, as opposed to going for the car right from the beginning, you can step up incrementally. And I do see what you're saying now. It makes something clicked in my head, which it took me a little bit longer than I actually would like to admit, on how you're able to do things much faster that way, because you're not having to go through the intricacies of building a car. You're able to, it's like you dumb it down to a skateboard, and then that works, that's great, we're out of here.
Yeah, exactly. So the principle from software engineering that we actually try and use the most, and the sentence that we use the most, is you ain't gonna need it.
That's what, yeah. So you have that hanging on your wall or somewhere.
Oh, maybe I should, yeah.
And then you can just show people that, point your finger to it. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that is really cool. All right, last piece of information that I want to bring up is that you not only do all this, but you got a friend that was part of the Tour de France and was on a team that went through.
He was a chef, yeah.
Oh, he was a chef for the Tour de France. And all right, so
for one of the teams, yeah.
I was going to call him a doper, but I guess. Well, maybe he still is. Who knows if he had fun and weekend. What is this story? You have a restaurant on the side?
Yeah, so actually now we had to close it but we had it for a couple of years, yeah. It's basically, the idea came from, we have this cycling group that rides very early in the morning at 5:40 a.m. called Oslo Dawn Patrol. And now there actually are dawn patrols in many other cities. Germany has one in Kiel, by the way, as well. And so basically what we would do after that, so we'd be done riding at like 7 a.m. So we'd be wanting to go eat breakfast together. And so we would go to usually a cafe, and then you'd be able to get a cinnamon bun and a coffee, but we wanted a place where we could have proper breakfast. And that's how this idea came along, and then it developed into an entire restaurant. But then, unfortunately, a group that we brought in as investors, they invested into too many locations at the same time and went bankrupt.
Oh, no.
And so when we were looking for a new investor to join us, this new potential investor instead turned around and made a better offer to our location and then snatched our location away from us.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. It's a difficult business.
Cutthroat. Wow.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that.
No, but it was really a fun experience to work on that. But yeah, the restaurant business is difficult.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. Well, I guess that's all then. It just shows you. Life will show you where you need to focus. And it seems like you are better off focusing on enabling the teams at your company and helping them get things into production and leverage the data and machine learning and analytics capabilities that are out there. It's been incredible talking with you, Alessandra. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.